This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Listen, we've got a really special interview. I want to get right to it. I don't want to take up any more of his time. John Wesley Dean III is perhaps best known for the 1,000 days he spent as legal counsel to President Richard Nixon during Watergate, one of the most historic events in our nation's modern history. He is an investment banker, lecturer, and the author of 7 best-selling books of nonfiction, including Blind Ambition, Lost Honor, Worse Than Watergate, and most recently, Conservatives Without Conscience. John Dean joins us today on Charlottesville Right Now. How are you, sir?
Pleasure.
I want to thank you for joining us today and for spending a little time with the listeners here in Virginia.
It's a great neighborhood. I know it well.
Did you get to spend some time down here?
I was over in Stanton for years, in my prep school years.
Oh, no kidding. I didn't know that. How about that? Now, was your family from Virginia or?
No, I was from Ohio, but I came down there to school. In fact, that's where I met Barry Goldwater Jr. and the son of the senator who is behind this book.
Well, that's a perfect transition to my first question. Let's just jump right into it. Your book is actually dedicated to the memory of Senator Barry Goldwater. And if you could, for the youngsters in our audience, tell us who Barry Goldwater was, what he means to our political heritage, and why he is, in your words, a conservative with conscience.
Well, let me give a plug to something I had nothing to do with. It'll really help a lot of people understand Barry Goldwater. HBO in September, I think it's around the 15th or the 17th of September, is running a program called Mr. Conservative, and it's a documentary on Senator Goldwater covering his entire life, including his 1964 bid for the presidency, which really resulted in the initial growth of the conservative movement. His book, The Conscience of a Conservative, certainly was one of those eye-openers for me in my political awakening. While I'd known the senator since I was about 13, it wasn't until I got into college that I sort of dawned on me, this man has some very interesting philosophies. And I really, to this day, consider myself a Goldwater conservative on most issues.
And that documentary, of course, HBO documentary, do we know again when it's coming out?
It's mid-September.
Okay.
As I say, his granddaughter, Cece Goldwater, got some great old footage and material in the family archives and put this together with the people at HBO. And I just saw it the other night, and it's a wonderful job. And it's mid-September that it's airing, and it's just a nice retrospective of the senator.
Great. Well, we'll keep that in mind. And so what does he mean to you? Why should we care about Barry Goldwater?
As I say, I'd known him since I was a kid. And when I was in Washington, first in the on Capitol Hill and then later at the Justice Department in the White House, I had business dealings with him, and we stayed in close touch all those years. His son and I are still best of friends, and I stayed in touch with him after he left the Senate. And in 1994, I happened to call him, and we got caught talking about what had happened to conservatism. And he was sort of mystified and miffed at the incivility that had become so common to conservative politics. He said, I just don't understand where this is coming from. There's just nothing conservative about it. And he said, I don't understand why the religious right has now taken charge of the Republican Party. He said, I think any man or woman should have every belief they want to hold is theirs to hold. But when you start bringing those into the public square with the understanding that you're not willing to compromise, you create problems. And that's exactly what, indeed, he was very prescient in telling me. He said, you know, I think conservatism goes down this road, it's going to divide the country, and that's exactly what's happened.
You write in the introduction of the book, and again, the book is Conservatives Without Conscience. We are talking to the author, John Dean. You write that there are 3 kinds of conservatives, the good, the bad, and the evil. This book is about the bad and evil ones. Many of my friends are conservatives, and they will remain my friends after reading this book, and some may even thank me for writing it. Moderates, progressives, and liberals may appreciate that someone with inside knowledge of conservatism has finally explained what the hell has happened to these people. Let me ask you then, Mr. Dean, what the hell has happened?
I found a body of information that I was not even aware existed, and it's about 40 years, 50 years, half century of study by social scientists who began after World War II asking the question, could it happen here, what happened in Italy and Germany under Mussolini and Hitler? The short answer they found was yes. That research has become more refined as time has passed. It now, as I say, represents about a half century of work. And it developed and reported that there is a personality they call the authoritarian personality. It's a person who very easily submits to authority figures. They find comfort and security in doing so. Fear often drives them. Just the uncertainties of daily life can drive a lot of people to become authoritarian followers. And they are typically very conventional people, but they also, once they submit to the authority, they become very aggressive on behalf of that authority. And they lose all critical faculties, it seems, once they start following. The other group are the leaders. They have been studied more recently, probably only about the last decade, and they're the social dominators, people who want personal power. They believe themselves superior to others. They have no interest in equality. They don't see the world as others being equal to them, but rather they're always superior, and they constantly test as being amoral. Now, there are a lot of other things, traits these people have, and these aren't labels that social scientists have hung on these people. These are things these people say about themselves in literally, as I say, 40 years of testing, time after time after time, and literally hundreds of thousands of questions and tens of thousands of people. So it's a very, very reliable, scientific, hard evidence empirical database. These people also, the higher they test on these questionnaires, the more conservative they are. And it answered so many questions that I didn't know the answer to, and I believe it's a very valid finding.
John Dean is our guest. The book is Conservatives Without Conscience. Mr. Dean, you write in your book, basically you make the argument, and I should say it's one of the most interesting histories of modern conservatism in America. One whole chapter there really looks at all the nuts and the bolts of how it has evolved, where it came from. Fascinating. You write that basically we're looking at a conservative movement that has been overtaken by authoritarianism, but you are careful to say that it's not dictatorial and it's not totalitarian. Is this just semantics, or is it important for us to understand and appreciate that distinction?
I think it's important to understand the distinction, and let me make it for you. First, let me say that not all conservatives are authoritarians, and not all authoritarians are conservative. There are very few, however, authoritarians who fall on the left. In fact, it is so small that it's statistically not even significant for social science research. But as far as the distinction between an authoritarian, let me first of all say, strong leaders don't necessarily always become authoritarian, and they certainly aren't all authoritarian personalities. FDR is a strong leader. He is not an authoritarian personality. Ronald Reagan really isn't an authoritarian personality either. So you can have a lot of mix, but when you get into the authoritarian personality, he could be a dictator, but that doesn't mean he would be. You could have an authoritarian who is, well, we do. We have an authoritarian president and vice president, and they're certainly not dictators.
Let's explore that a little bit more after this break. We're going to take a very quick break, and then when we get back, we'll talk in some detail here about looking at the Bush-Cheney administration in light of what you've learned and you have laid out in your most recent book. We are talking with John Dean, his latest book, Conservatives Without Conscience. This is Charlottesville right now. We're talking with John Dean. His latest book is Conservatives Without Conscience. If we can, let's apply some of what you've learned to the Bush-Cheney administration. And to get that going, in 2004, you said, quote, "This administration is truly scary and frighteningly dangerous," end quote. Was that over the top, or do you still feel that way?
I still feel that way. While Conservatives Without Conscience doesn't focus on Bush and Cheney, they certainly, their coming to Washington when they did helped authoritarianism to blossom in Washington, and they certainly are authoritarian personalities. What I find frightening about them is the secrecy with which they've operated throughout their presidency. When I did Worse Than Watergate, the secret presidency of George Bush, I really looked at that secrecy before anybody was really in the certainly in the mainstream media, was acknowledging that it's a fact. It was the most secret president we've ever had.
You actually wrote that book before the NSA wiretapping scandal, before Valerie Plame, before Dick Cheney went to Capitol Hill to lobby for the use of torture.
I did.
Would you want to change the title to Much Worse Than Watergate?
No, I'll leave it where it is. I, for example, take torture. I can't imagine Richard Nixon in his darkest moment. He's a former World War II vet. He's somebody I watched up close handle My Lai, that massacre, and he was disgusted with it. I can't imagine him ever sending his vice president to the Capitol Hill to lobby for torture. He knew it was ineffective and didn't believe in it. But yet here we have it in this presidency, and it's the most striking authoritarian sort of action I've seen in a long time from a presidency. And it's conservatism without conscience in spades.
What do you say then? There are millions of people out there, and there's a lot of them listening to this show right now, who truly believe in their heart that this administration is acting in their best interest and is doing just what they have to do to protect this country. We were attacked.
I don't question motives at all. I certainly hope I'm not pejorative in any sense in my writing. I don't mean to be if I am. I try to be firm, straight ahead, and descriptive. And what I think when you're dealing with authoritarians like Bush and Cheney is they are well-meaning. They are men of zeal, however, and authoritarians do not like critical thinking. They do not want the world helping them to examine what to do and what not to do. They become very insular, very isolated, and they make lots of mistakes. You follow the history of any authoritarian, both in the United States or outside, and it's not a pretty picture of where they end up. Look at J. Edgar Hoover, is a classic authoritarian personality, and he literally ran the FBI into the ground, breaking liberties and violating rights of people. He's sort of a mini, he's a wonderful sort of test tube example of what happens when somebody who is an authoritarian remains unchecked and in power.
At the height of the, you know, we are in Charlottesville, so I've got to do this. At the height of the Alien and Sedition Acts, James Madison wrote to Thomas Jefferson and said, "Perhaps it is a universal truth that the loss of liberty of home is to be charged to provisions against danger, real or pretended, from abroad." Do you think of that? Does that make sense in light of what we're experiencing today?
Well, I think, you know, there's always a balance. You know, that's take the Goldwater sort of libertarian philosophy on conservatism. And I keep coming back because I knew the senator and I know his material so well. Where would he be today on an issue like terrorism? Well, I know exactly where he'd be. When government has to provide security and they have to weigh it in and balance it with the freedom of individuals, he would always come down on the side of protecting that freedom. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. A lot of authoritarians absolutely roll over freedom. Whatever, sure, you can do a lot of things if you have a police state. You could reduce crime, you could solve the drug problem, you could get homeless off the street, but we'd also not have the country we live in and what we fight for.
Think of all the crimes we could solve if we put a camera in every home.
Exactly. You could have preemptive crime attacks. Just see it on the camera and move before anyone even knew they'd violated the crime.
Absolutely. If I hear you right, your book is a warning. Is it fair to characterize it that way?
That's certainly the spirit with which it was written, as very much a warning. Because I, you know, when you look at where authoritarian behavior goes, it is proto-fascist behavior. I don't say that we're on the road to fascism. In fact, we're not. I did talk to a lot of experts about fascism, did a lot of reading in it, and a number of these people told me, in essence, the same thing. If fascism ever comes as a result of another 9/11 in this country, it will be with a smile on its face, and we will want to give up our rights and liberties, foolishly so, but that's the way we'll get headed down this road. And so I am trying to warn people what can happen. I am trying to show that about 23 to 25% of the American people are rock hard authoritarian or authoritarian followers, that they are insensitive to what much of what they're doing. They're very zealous in doing it, and they have to be checked and watched. Not that they can't, they're entitled to do whatever they want to, but, you know, authoritarianism may work well, say, in the military. It doesn't do well running a democracy.
John Dean is our guest. His books include Blind Ambition, Lost Honor, Worse Than Watergate, and most recently, Conservatives Without Conscience. Sir, if we're not on the road to fascism, God forbid that we ever are, what will it look like? I mean, what should we, the average citizen, what should we be looking for? Because it's not going to look like Germany. It's not going to look like Italy. What should be the warning signs? Are we already seeing them?
Well, as I in talking to people who not know much more about fascism than I do, and I cite a few of them in the book, they tell me, as I said, that fascism will be very friendly. It'll be smiling. We will be so frightened we think we need to give up this or that right, that we don't care if there are warrantless wiretaps. We don't care that we have a country that runs prisons that don't provide any rights to people. These are first steps. These are the way you incubate it. And, you know, how it would ultimately come out, I don't think anybody can know for certain. As one of the experts I talked to pointed out to me, and I actually was so amazed when I paused to think about it, Bob Altmaier, I put him on a quote right at the outset in the front matter of the book, where he said, if we don't think you could ever elect an Adolf Hitler in America, realize that if only the white vote had counted in David Duke's race, he would have been elected. And he's a declared Nazi.
Head of the KKK, yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, it's just one of these things that vigilance is called for, and that's what this book hopefully tries to alert people to something I was totally unaware of, and that's authoritarian science that has shown, you know, what these problems are. These academics, for some reason, inexplicably to me, have never taken this information to the public square. They don't write about it for the general reader. I spent a year plus plowing through, you know, very technical, sophisticated, jargon-loaded, statistics-filled material to tease all this information out. I had a very good mentor and assistance with Bob Altmaier, who's one of the leading researchers who I got to just at the perfect moment when he had time to help me get into this material. But it's material and information that needs to be out for people to understand. I'm trying to encourage people like Altmaier and others to write about this for the general public and the general reader. This is too important to leave on just within the academy to talk about and worry about.
The book is Conservatives Without Conscience. We are talking to the author, John Dean. If you'll hang with me here just for a few moments, we're going to take a break for some local news here at the bottom of the hour, a little weather, and we'll be back with John Dean in the second half of this hour. Again, the book is Conservatives Without Conscience. You're listening to News Radio 1070 WINA, Charlottesville, right now. John Dean is perhaps best known for the 1,000 days he spent as legal counsel to President Richard Nixon during Watergate. He is an investment banker, lecturer, and the author of 7 best-selling books of nonfiction, including Blind Ambition, Lost Honor, Worse Than Watergate, and most recently, Conservatives Without Conscience. Mr. Dean, if we could turn the subject a little bit, we've touched on it thus far in the last half hour, but if we could talk in more in depth about the rise of religious fundamentalism, which, if I read your book correctly, you that's not a good thing in your eyes.
Well, I don't try to you know, be critical in any way of religious beliefs. What I'm pointing out...
No, and I didn't read that at all in the book.
No. What happened is in religious fundamentalists really had withdrawn from politics after the Scopes trial in 1925 down in Tennessee. They didn't like the process. They were very disappointed what happened. There were a lot of people belittled their beliefs at the time. And so they really withdrew. Their children, who as they grew up in this withdrawn condition, decided they wanted to get active again. They called themselves evangelicals and became very active and became attracted to politics when Jimmy Carter ran as a born-again Christian, and this got their attention. However, they very quickly decided that they didn't like most of Carter's policies, so they didn't long stay in the Democratic camp, but rather became very active in trying to get getting Carter out of the White House and getting Ronald Reagan in. And Reagan gave them a lot of, you know, suggestion that he would help them in some of their rather limited agenda, where they want things like, Roe v. Wade brought a lot of them into the play as well, to reverse that, to school prayer issues like teaching evolution in schools, homeschooling, It's not a big agenda, but it's very important to these people, and they're not willing to compromise on any of these beliefs because they believe that this is what God wants them to do. So, as I say, they didn't get satisfaction from Reagan, so they stayed to play, and this is where they really get organized, a lot around the Pat Robertson campaign. He accumulated a massive number of names, and between the moral majority getting organized early in the 70s, and then Pat Robertson's run, they really put together an organizational drive to influence politics. And it's with that, and they're very authoritarian by nature of their religious beliefs, they brought authoritarian wisdom into the conservative movement, and it's grown from there.
You quote, President Carter in your book as writing, this is Jimmy Carter saying, this nation's leaders once extolled state and local autonomy, attempted to control deficit spending, avoided foreign adventurism, minimized long-term peacekeeping commitments, preserved the separation of church and state, and protected civil liberties and personal privacy. However, today's leaders have placed far more divisive issues at the center of their platform. Abortion, the death penalty, science versus religion, women's rights, the separation of religion and politics, homosexuality. Narrowly defined theological beliefs have been adopted as the rigid agenda of a political party.
Very true. And it's, as I say, it's not without its consequences. And what I want to do is understand, you know, why is this, what is the nature of this movement? And it is clearly, when I ran into this body of science relating to authoritarianism, it is just right on the mark. It explains that behavior down to minor details.
John Dean is our guest. The book is Conservatives Without Conscience. I think one of the most important things that you wrote in the book is that you said these people aren't going to change. The authoritarian followers, people who enjoy blindly following a leader, whether that's on the left or the right, and as you say, there's not much of that on the left, and there's a whole lot on the right, they're not going to change. And at best, if you're not one of them, the best thing you can do is really keep an eye on them.
That's exactly right. And the other thing is, you can, however, the researchers tell me, you can influence people in the sense that if there's another terror attack and they become frightened again, they won't automatically think, well, the answer to this is to follow an authoritarian leader, but rather to have more thoughtful response where there are such things as black and white and, excuse me, they're grays rather than just black and white. There is nuance. There are not all issues as crystal clear as the authoritarian would make them because the world is more complex than that. So you can, by education and awareness of authoritarianism, prevent some people from sort of easily sliding into being an authoritarian follower thoughtlessly. So that's one of the goals in a book like this.
You know, Thomas Jefferson had a great quote. It's one of my favorite. He said, "I have sworn upon the altar of God eternal hostility to every form of tyranny over the mind of man." Now, what most people aren't aware of, though, is that Jefferson actually said that not in reference to the king or to England or to any army, but he said that specifically in regards to the church. And it was his great fear that religious zealots would gradually, inch by inch, move into political life in America and shape public policy to their advantage. It sounds like Jefferson's tyranny is your authoritarianism. Is that
it is? It certainly is. It certainly has all the markings of that. And of course, Jefferson thought one of the highlight points of his career was what he'd done in Virginia with keeping church and state separate. And I think that is one of his great contributions. While it was not written in stone into the Constitution, I think it's always been implicitly in there. And of course, the religious right disagrees with that. They would like to redefine all that and take us into a solid theocracy, which is a pure authoritarian arrangement.
Yeah, Jefferson's Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom preceded the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights by a decade.
That's right.
Can we turn back a little bit to the Bush-Cheney administration? You have said that when President Bush was bypassing the FISA requirements on wiretapping American citizens, which we should point out, FISA was a direct result of the Watergate scandal, if I'm not mistaken.
It really was. In the aftermath of Watergate, as you know, there were continued investigations about the abuses undertaken by the various intelligence agencies, and the Church Committee report, which is now online and available to a lot of people if they want to read these and be recalled what, you know, how things got out of hand. FISA was a solution to put an intermediary in between a law enforcement or a police agency or a military agency, for that matter, and the people of this country, so that you have, you don't go and intercept people's telephone calls without at least the thought of a judge determining whether that's justified or not, whether it really is called for or not. But, of course, Bush has gone around that. He's claimed that it's just too cumbersome. He doesn't even want Congress to seemingly touch it. He wants to just remain in defiance of the law.
And it's not like the FISA bar was ever set that high.
It was. There have been virtually no turndowns because the government knows they have to present a decent case, so they don't go in with nonsense cases. So we can only assume that today there's some very dubious wiretapping and surveillance going on.
You have said that this was the first time a president in American history actually confessed to an impeachable offense. Will you flesh that out for us?
Yeah, I that was in a conversation I had with Barbara Boxer, the senator from California, where I happen to live, and I was interviewing her on C-SPAN about her book, and we got into a discussion of that, and I made that comment because there's just no question that FISA it lays out in great detail what how to proceed, and it makes an exclusive statute for exactly the situation Bush is involved in. But yet has said he's just going to ignore the law. And the reason I say it's an impeachable offense, because this is one of the reasons that Richard Nixon was indeed impeached, as the committee was in making its inquiry, although he would resign before that actually happened, but was his use of a warrantless wiretaps of newsmen looking to track down national security leaks. So it's, you know, we have an exact on-point precedent with the Nixon impeachment inquiry.
And, of course, Nixon could have very easily have done what President Bush has done. He could have said, hey, we're at war. I have to protect my citizens of this country, and this is executive privilege.
One of the things that's very curious to me, I certainly think it's for Nixon's in his memory to is favorable, is that he did not abuse the so-called national security privileges. He did abuse what's just called straight executive privilege, based on the separations of powers, saying, this is mine, I don't have to turn it over to Congress, therefore, take a hike. Of course, he would famously lose a case in the Supreme Court when he tried to deny access to his own tapes, and that would force his resignation. But he did comply with the Supreme Court order, and a lot of people thought at that point, you know, what if he says no to the Supreme Court? As a matter of national security, I'm not going to turn those tapes over because they opened the door to a lot of very sensitive material, which indeed they did. And he could have said, listen, let the court enforce it, as was once famously said to the Supreme Court by a Virginian. but he didn't. He said, you know, I'll comply, and then he resigned. But, you know, I wonder if Bush, in a similar situation, and Cheney, would indeed honor a court decision. I don't know. Their precedent and their actions so far suggest they wouldn't.
John Dean is our guest. The book is Conservatives Without Conscience. You write in your book that the Bush-Cheney administration is arguably, you know, from their standpoint, fortunate to have what Nixon did not have, and that's a basic close staff of followers who are there for the long haul.
Well, that sort of surprised me in watching them set up the staff, and I watched this literally from the transition in 2000 on. I knew people who were associated with the transition, and they were telling me what was happening, and it's they set it up on a very need-to-know basis. Cheney had been a former White House chief of staff. He knew exactly how to structure it, ideally, going in, and did just that. He'd had problems with leaks as chief of staff, where a lot of people actually at one point who were still, when he was chief of staff to Gerald Ford, and there were still a lot of Nixon people on the White House staff, a number of them were saying, when Cheney arrived that they remembered Haldeman fondly, as opposed to Cheney, who was not quite as competent, they found. But anyway, so Cheney suffered these leaks, and so he set it up in a way that is about as airtight as possible. First of all, as to who knows what's going on in the White House, particularly when he created an oversized vice presidential staff that is nothing short of a shadow White House staff, and in many regards more powerful than the White House staff, and got some people who are actually more experienced and probably more able than a lot of the White House staffers. But he also set it up in a sense that they have deniability. They put in front of themselves their closest aides or people that they know will fall on a sword for them come what may. And that's the way the place operates. It's as I made somewhat facetiously, but to make the point, it's almost as if they drew on the best and brightest of La Casa Nostra to set this up. And this isn't the kind of transparency that has traditionally been part of the presidency. Yes, you can't. No president can operate in a fishbowl. I'd be the first to tell you that. But I've never seen any presidency as structured as secretly as this one is.
Now, some would argue that we are facing something that is unprecedented in our nation's history. So looking at the past, whether it's the Nixon administration or FDR, Reagan, is not going to help us, because this is very different from Pearl Harbor. We can't draw a circle on the map around the enemy.
Well, I would agree with that. But I'd also point out the fact that all this was done before 9/11. Much of this secrecy was laid in and planned before 9/11 even got on their radar. 9/11 has only been used, and it was used, I think, quite cleverly. About 2 weeks after 9/11, they realized the political potential of 9/11 and have exploited it ever since. In every conceivable way, in electoral ways, in trying to keep people frightened and voting their way. Cheney's out doing it right now on this latest terrorist attack or thwarted attack. And traditionally, presidents don't do that with a crisis. They try to give people hope rather than fear. I've looked at all the modern presidents, and the only one that even comes close is Nixon during his race in 68 and 72, sort of rattled the sword that, well, if you don't elect me, you know, the world may be in trouble. But it wasn't the heavy kind of fear-mongering that's going on now, and Nixon didn't do it to any extent when he was actually in office. But it's become the norm. It's become standard operating procedure for this presidency to keep people frightened, to keep terrorism as the forefront. But when you look statistically or risk assessment-wise at terrorism, it is not the most dangerous thing we face in this country by any stretch of the imagination. Yes, it's a serious problem. It's tragedy what happened on 9/11. But also, look, every death is a tragedy, and there's something like 3,000 drownings every year. There's something like 3,000-plus industrial accidents every year. And you can go right up the scale of what happens to our species, and just in daily life, up to heart disease and cancer, and realize we've got a lot of problems and a lot of threats that we take and accept, and we don't get all bent out of shape. During the Cold War, we certainly lived with the threat of annihilation, if you will, and got over it and stopped witch hunting and got rights and liberties back up where they belonged and won the war. And we've got to do the same with terrorism.
John Dean is our guest. My last question, just to go back to, if I could, just to talk about Watergate real quick.
Mm-hmm.
From your experience and your conversations over the last, 30-plus years, what is it that most Americans don't perhaps get about Watergate? What don't we know or understand that we should?
Well, I'm a lecturer and a visiting scholar over at the University of Southern California and have been for, 6-7 years now. And I notice how little the students today know about Watergate. It's really as distant as Teapot Dome or the Lincoln assassination or other ancient historical events. Although there are a lot of people still alive, those who tend to be about 45 or over who have very vivid memories of Watergate. Some who are precocious have memories that are even better. But it seems to me what's most striking about Watergate is how it's forgotten what it all meant. And it was serious abuse of presidential power and the creation of an imperial presidency. The problem is the Bush administration has come in with a design to create an imperial presidency on steroids, and it's not healthy.
John Dean, I want to thank you for spending some time with us here in Virginia. I know you are coming off the end of a very long book tour and probably in need of some rest. And the book, again, folks, is Conservatives Without Conscience. It's been an honor to talk to you, sir, and would look forward to the opportunity to talk with you again.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Absolutely. John Dean, former White House legal counsel to President Richard Nixon, an investment banker, lecturer, and author of a number of books. This interview will be archived in its entirety at CVillePodcast.com. You're listening to Charlottesville right now.